and see if we can get all the way to Newton before the evening is over. I think, in fact, you've read enough and heard enough if you've read the appendix to that book, Drake's Speculation About What Happened at Bellarmine's House, and you heard Westfall's lecture. You really have enough material to begin to think pretty deeply about what happened to Galileo. But let's just run over it very quickly. Basically, what happens is that a friend of humanism, a friend of Galileo's, is appointed pope on the death of Paul V, who's a Borghese pope, Maffeo Barberini, and Galileo and all his friends see this quite clearly as an opportunity to enhance his standing and perhaps to make the kind of intervention in the course of events that Galileo clearly wants to make this, to try to influence the policy of the church, which, no, it's not fair to call it the church, it's the church and state in some way combined, to influence the policy as regards education and all those things that will follow from enlightened policy making. And Galileo wants to argue, as you saw in the letter to Christina, for a redistribution, a net redistribution of intellectual authority towards what he's trying to define as the new science and away from theology as the queen of the sciences. Pause at some point and look at some of the arguments in the letter to Christina, which Westfall didn't talk about too much in his lecture. Nonetheless, Galileo's project is pretty clear, and the most charitable version of it is to deny that he's a zealot for the Copernican cause, that he is somehow insistent that Copernicanism be accepted. The minimum claim he wants to make, I think, is that what Westfall said, and everyone I think knows, that the church ought not to commit itself on matters in natural philosophy where it might turn out that it's wrong. It shouldn't commit itself on this Copernican proposal because it might turn out they're wrong. Anyway, Galileo and the new pope apparently walk a Galileo visits Rome, and they stroll in the Vatican Gardens and talk about Galileo's project, and one of them is this treatise on reflux and regress of the sea. And as we ended up last time, I noticed for you that Barberini, is Urban VIII, is particularly pleased with this idea, with this jewel of intellectual life that he can count as among his circle, and that what this treatise on this treatise on the two systems of the world, comparing and contrasting the arguments for and against the Ptolemaic and the Copernican scheme, the Pope thinks this is going to be wonderful because it's going to show how the science of mortal beings, human science at its best, reaches an impasse. Theory and observation cannot settle the issue. Science cannot definitively, decisively settle whether Ptolemaic or Copernican theory is true. Is that the other fact? And we realize, we come to realize an enlargement of our faith by the discovery that God could have brought the appearances into being in any number of ways, many of which we haven't even or might not ever think of, and so we ought to be more humble with respect to these hypotheses that we entertain. So on those terms, Galileo sets out to produce his book. He does produce it, and as you can imagine, especially given the context that Westfall talks about, it simply enrages his opponents, particularly the Jesuits, who are Aristotelians of one kind or another, who have been savagely caricatured in the form of Simplicio. And the Pope himself is, apparently there's good evidence, is personally affronted by the way the book turns out, with his own position as a learned person is ridiculed by having put in the mouth of Simplicio. In other words, as you can see, given the tone of the book, it just doesn't turn out very well to have this sort of simpering, weak-willed, immature, childish, disabled character, Simplicio, haul out as his kind of last bit of solace that we mere mortals can't ever fully comprehend the wonders of God's works. There's a kind of silence between the lines, certainly not weak-minded simps like you, Simplicio, couldn't ever begin to. This is a perfectly appropriate position for somebody as weak-minded as yourself. But us heroic, robust, adult types can do perfectly well, thank you, if we follow Salviati's lead. Anyway, somewhere in the middle of all this, the idea is that the officials who are in charge of these things ought to check the Galileo file, because it looks as if he might have acted in violation of the Anti-Copernican Decree of 1616. And so the Holy Office is instructed to look at the file and see where things stand. And there in the file they find this memo from 1616 that is apparently somewhat irregular because it's not properly signed or anything. But there it is, saying that at Bellarmine's residence in February 1616, whatever it is, Galileo was instructed by the Commissar General of the Inquisition not to teach, hold, or defend the Copernican theory in any way whatsoever. When the Pope sees this, you have to remember now, in 1633, Bellarmine's dead. All of the dramatis personae of this 1616 incident are gone. All that's left are the records and Galileo. So the Pope sees this document and now is not only in some sense personally offended, but it appears that he's been had. It would appear the Pope now has evidence in front of him that Galileo has neglected to tell him that in fact he's been instructed not to write a book of the sort that the both of them chatted about doing, and the Pope was so happy he would do. In other words, Galileo never mentioned what an honorable person might mention. Oh, by the way, there was an official instruction that I'm not permitted to defend the Copernican theory in any way whatsoever. Now, do you think that's going to be a problem? Well, Galileo never mentions this to him, so now he's triply angry, and so Galileo's going to have to come to Rome, it appears he's. Well, it appears he simply violated the law as it stands in this sort of semi-police state. If you wanted to read all the details about this, you would enjoy probably Giorgio de Santillana's book about the crime of Galileo and his interpretation of the situation, which I think is basically right. Now we're talking about the details of the trial. Is that when it gets into the trial, both sides are in fact taken by surprise. We've seen how the outside of the church bureaucracy, the Holy Office and its various officers, and the Pope are in some sense, well, the Pope's taken by surprise by this memo. Other officers, just, it's routine stuff. There it is, and you act accordingly. Galileo's taken by surprise by what he finally finds out is the claim that he has been instructed not to write the sort of book he actually wrote. So he's in deep trouble. But he, as Drake explains, he's not worried about this finally once he realizes what the charges are, because he has this memo he got from Bellarmine. When he had visited Bellarmine and returned to Florence, rumors had circulated that he had been forced to endure or forced to do penance or some sort of thing. And in order to keep his reputation clean, he wrote to Bellarmine and said, will you please write a memo, a document, a reference letter that says none of these things ever happened. And so he has in hand this memo from Bellarmine that he was never instructed. He was simply told of the findings of the commission of 1616, period. Nothing else happened. Now that's the complicated stuff that Drake's trying to untangle. How could we have these two contradictory documents? Oh, and that one's real. I mean, there's just no getting away from it. And I think it's very interesting, Santillana's point, that one does have to, and especially thinking in these days of the modern state, one does have to hold a little bit of respect for the church for saving all these documents and not trying to shred them. Right? It's very tempting to just shred the whole lot and be done with it. But had they, here's Bellarmine's own archive, and there's his own draft of this letter to Galileo. So the church is right in this sense of the long view. It wouldn't have done any good to try to hide these things, because these documents, evidence turns up in various places. Or, let's put it this way, if you want to go on a shredding campaign, you better shred everything. Just everything, completely. Anyhow, so there's that tangled thing that Drake is trying to untangle. Santillana thinks that probably that memo is just a plain forgery. That some Dominican, probably, some right-wing person, but possibly some Jesuit, somebody with access to the files, somebody in the Holy Office, in or around 1616, simply plants this false document in the file with the idea that one day this will trap him. In other words, it's setting a snare for Galileo. It may not be this year, it may not be next year, it may be 20 years, but this will get him. Drake rather doubts that for the reasons he gives, but Santillana thinks he's got evidence of that forgery. Anyway, whatever it is that happened, when in the hearing Galileo produces his memo, now the officers of the Inquisition are in for a surprise, because they didn't know it existed, and they realize all of a sudden that their case has rather dribbled right through their fingers. They don't have the case against Galileo they thought they did. And so now what ensues, and you know, you can know as much about this as you want. If you want to read tons of correspondence and lots of documents and so on, there's lots of details to find out. But what ensues is a kind of elaborate negotiation trying to enable both sides to save face. And the more powerful side will try to save more face. But it's pretty plain that we've got to do some face saving here. The church can't go ahead with the prosecution it intended. On the other hand, it can't let Galileo go completely. So this negotiation begins, and the mediator in all of this is the cardinal nephew, Francesco Barberini, who's the chief librarian of the Vatican Library. And he's going back and forth between the two sides, trying to figure out who will accept what. And the mediation he works out finally is that Galileo will confess to having screwed up, to having been arrogant, to having been more zealous on behalf of the Copernican doctrine than he intended to be. In other words, he'll confess to having made this kind of rhetorical error. He will also swear that he doesn't know the Copernican doctrine is true. And he will confess his faith and his deference and his obedience. In exchange for this, in exchange for doing that, he will not be imprisoned or have terribly harsh penalties. He will be put under perpetual house arrest, which is not great. I mean, we all know that. But for a 72-year-old man to be told that he's going to have to stay at his villa outside Florence, and the comings and goings of visitors will be monitored, and he'll have to apply for permission to take a trip. This is not terribly harsh. That's no, I think
the tour of the
day. You know, they didn't argue whether that was just to shake them up or whether they were rooted on the union.
I think the way to understand that, though I could be wrong, is that this is part of an automatic procedure. It's as if it were built in to our justice system that, well, something like this almost is built in, that the accused be reminded of the penalties if the accused is found guilty. In other words, my understanding of, and the prisoner was shown the instruments of torture, it's not that they wouldn't be used, everyone knows they get used, which is part of why they're effective as part of the procedure. But what I'm saying is there's a formulaic business where at a certain stage in this inquisition, it is now appropriate to show the accused the instruments of torture. It's a formula. It doesn't imply there's any intention to use them, although one can imagine circumstances under which they would be. But what my sense of it is, which is not completely well informed, but it is my sense of it, that anyone reaching the stage of the inquiry Galileo has reached will have this formula applied. In fact, it may be so formulaic as to be false. That is, Galileo isn't shown the instruments of torture. This is code for we've reached a stage of the inquiry where we want to sort of pause, take a breath, and let's go back over the stuff. Well, what I've been saying is it's my understanding, largely from Stillman Drake's biography of Galileo, that he signs the confession as the result of this lengthy mediation. And he's not signing the confession because somebody says, if you don't sign, we'll put thumb screws on you or put you on the rack. He signs it because his friends and the bureaucrats have agreed on this solution to the problem. He will suffer no worse fate than house arrest if he will confess to something that even he has to admit is half true, at least half true. And I can imagine him persuading himself that he can also swear that he doesn't believe the Copernican doctrine if he can be encouraged to understand that what that means is, do you know for certain that it is true? Do you see what I mean? In other words, do you truly claim knowledge that the Copernican theory is true? If he did sign such a thing, there's a good chance we'd think as badly of him, if only because it's false. There's no damned epicycles, you know? The Copernican theory is false, and everyone finds out it's false within about 25 years, strictly speaking. And if you wanted to get really esoteric about it, it's entirely possible that in 1986 it might be difficult to claim that you know the Earth moves. If it is as simple as, do you know that the Earth is a moving body in what, absolute space? I mean, there are ways of formulating a physical geometry that leaves the Earth quite happily not moving. But remember, that's only screwy given a particular physics. The whole point of Einstein's physics is to get rid of goofy things like gravitational forces, which don't make any sense, or which are inexplicable. Inexplicable, I guess would be right. They make perfect sense if you don't ask what they are. Right? So all I'm saying is, it's my comprehension of all this is that it really is two projects, as it were, colliding in the dark. It's not as if they haven't had their headlights on. Galileo knows what he's doing. The Jesuits know what they're doing. The Holy Office knows what it's doing. But, like most bureaucracies, you've confronted bureaucracies, eh? You know, it's pretty hard. They're not terribly flexible. You know, once you turn the switch on, the damn thing just rumbles along doing what it has to do. Fill this out in triplicate, send this to this, take that to that office. And if you say to it, what the hell is the point of this? The answer is, this is how we do these things. And you're helpless. Now, in one sense, Galileo just, everybody knows that. He has fallen afoul of the Holy Office, and now he's going to have to go through this song and dance, which they run out.
Okay? Does he just admit that it may not be true because of the pressure, or does he actually start to think?
I think what he realizes is that he's in a lot of trouble. And that these guys can't lose face as much as he might want them to. And they're just not willing to. And it's too bad, but that's what this has come to. I mean, this is the institution that has burned people. I'm not trying to whitewash the situation, but I am trying to see how it might, I'm trying to explore as far as we can what it might look like to think that the church isn't simply unreasonable. They have a bigger vision, they've got to save face, they can't lose lots of credibility. There are some ways in which Galileo has screwed up. That is, he's attempted to be very authoritative and convincing about things that he doesn't really know much about. We were talking about that last time. Is he aware of the degree to which, I can imagine Bellarmine thinking something like this, is he aware of the degree to which, now Bellarmine's dead, but some equivalent, is he aware of the degree to which he's flirting with what looks like Lutheran theology? You know, that business of nature has nothing to do with human affairs. It's just engineering. The potter knows more about nature than all you Jesuits. You know? Well, he may be walking into something he doesn't know about too much. What this all means.
That's my question. I mean, you know, why doesn't he foresee this to some extent? Or does he? Just does it anyway? I mean, it almost seems pretty bright. You'd think he'd see that he was going to be walking into this situation by what he wrote.
Well, I think if we knew more, what we'd know, I mean, if I was going to work on this for 10 years, what I would look for is what I think is surely there. One tendency, even within the Jesuit intellectual elite, that is moving towards a kind of Lutheran theology. It's certainly there in the Roman Church. And it may simply be this business of Galileo wants to change the world before breakfast. And we have this, we guys who are in charge think it ought to proceed more like Francis Bacon wants it to. Now there's a contemporary who has a liberal view of change, who thinks that I'm sort of leaping ahead to remind you something that's not, it's out of the same intellectual milieu in a way. Francis Bacon thinks the best kind of social change is the kind that occurs by invisible increments, so that it happens without your knowing it, or without it being painful or wrenching or dislocating. It's almost like a kind of Darwinian. It's evolution. Now it may be, if we looked real hard, this is exactly what the people that are prosecuting Galileo are on about. You're just making too much of a... If we did what you said, it would... it would mean an awful lot of work, and we're not prepared to go through it. There's too much else to worry about.
But are there any explicit connections made between Galileo and Luther by the... And as you say, within the Jesuit community itself, there would be people... Augustine was... father of the church.
Augustine's a real guy. His status has gone down a bit since. I mean, the Council of Trent examines all this very carefully. This paper I told you about by Peterson, it's in the Journal of the History of Astronomy. Right, Olaf Peterson, P-U-D-E-R-S-O-N. It's in the Journal of the History of Astronomy. It's called Galileo and the Council of Trent. Okay. If you look at the Council of Trent, here's a bunch of people, it's like a papal commission. They spend years and years and years discussing the implications of all these different things. And natural philosophy is a part of it. And the post-Tridentine church, which means the church after Trent, of which Bellarmine is a leading figure, is committed to the Council of Trent, is making policy for the Counter-Reformation Church. And what they set up is a bunch of ways to carry on. And as Westphal said, in the early 17th century, they might have every reason to believe, particularly because of the Jesuits, that they are going to win this one. If you're looking for the best and the brightest, you're going to find them in the Roman Church, not in the woods of Germany. Yeah.
I'm going to answer the Frank question about how could Galileo look at this when the light of the fact that he had the memo signed by Bellarmine, which gave him his limitations. He was operating on the faith that everybody else was playing by the same rules he was, and so when he blithely went ahead and wrote his book and submitted it to the censors, he was maybe pushing the limits of his letter of permission, but he was, he was working within it. And then they hauled out this other one saying, from left field. So he probably was, within the letter, if not the spirit of the law type of thing, as he understood it.
And he was willing to play fast and loose with what seems to be his pal, Maffeo Barberini's idea of what he's doing. He's willing to take a risk with that and push it.
Is the introduction of this questionable document, which of course, under the time that you have to show it,
it strikes me that it's possible that if there had not been this questionable document, they would have found something else.
It happened either.
I mean, it does look like, particularly because, I mean, it's just plain as day, the Pope is absolutely on the verge of stroke. When the message is, when the Inquisitor in Florence is told, it's like the motor vehicle branch, there's an office of the Inquisition everywhere, and there's an officer in charge, and this is an international organization, when the chief inquisitor in the Florence office is told, get Galileo to Rome, tell him he must appear in Rome now, Galileo says, he pleads for some, what, it's not mercy, some consideration. He says, I'm 72, I have a double hernia, I have arthritis, I have rheumatism, I'm sick, I'm not sure I'll survive the trip. And the message back from Rome is, we said now. I mean, that it's just, it's very harsh. And it's coming right from the top. So he's in trouble.
He's a tough bird, though, if he managed to weasel his way out with the, having infuriated the Pope as much as he did and managed to get his house.
Well, I mean, at some point we have to become almost like historical journalists. You know, what's going on in cabinet? Who knows who? What's happening here? Who negotiated that? I mean, it really is mundane as can be. And just full of real ordinary stuff. And that sounds right. I mean, that's what you'd expect. These people don't know this is going to become, you know, they're not saying to each other, boy, in 300 years, they're still going to be talking about this. I mean, they might suspect there's something fairly important going on here, but they don't know how the story turns out. In fact, they want it to turn out differently. That's why they're doing what they're doing.
They right? Buy that. He says about Joseph, where he sort of says, if you look at the Bible, you know, and one of them was wrong.
Yes.
Is it Jacob? I can't remember. Something about one of the passages.
Yes.
And he says, if you look at it, you can see it from the description, and he falls upon that as some proof or evidence that.
You're talking about in the letter to Christina.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Joshua and the sun standing
right,
still.
Right, right.
Oh, well, I mean, there's an example of how to penetrate what Galileo thinks he's doing. I mean, here's the letter to Christina. He's building up this whole case that, look, there's the Book of Nature and the Book of God. And we all know there's Book of God experts called the Holy Fathers and the Interpreters of Scripture. And one of the big arguments in the Council of Trent was how much Koine Greek, Aramaic, Hebrew, and so on, do you have to be a master of in order to be one of these Book of God experts? And there's a big fight in the Council of Trent about, and there's one kind of conservative-minded, more middle-aged types that say, Latin's good, if Latin's good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for us. Right? I mean, they're kind of...
Jesus didn't even know Latin. Technicalities.
I have it on reliable authority that something almost like that was said in the Alberta legislature when they were discussing the B&B Act. One of the wonderful representatives of the people of Alberta said, the hell with this. Well, he didn't say that. He said, if English is good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for us. Right. Stunningly penetrating right to the heart of the issue. Right. And the people who win the day in the Council of Trent are the scholars who say, if you want to interpret scripture, you'd better know Hebrew and Greek and all those other things. This is goofy to them. Anyway, so here's Galileo knowing this. And saying there is this kind of authority that accrues to those who are expert in interpreting scripture, but I want to show you there's also a kind of authority that accrues to those who are expert at reading the Book of Nature. And then there's all this discussion about what to do when they don't agree, because clearly there's only one truth.
But the interesting thing in all this is that Galileo makes it much easier to find out what the truths of nature are. So he always leaves the truths of scripture to catch up. They have to be sort of
well, there is this
coerced
shift.
Into...
He does kind of shift the burden, you notice. The Book of Nature experts can say whatever seems to them to be right, and it's going to be up to the Book of Scripture experts to show they're wrong. Did you notice that?
I mean, that's the first place where you're, hey, wait a minute. You just said they don't know anything about this. Now you're going to tell them they've got to show you're wrong? And he says, yeah, because when you think you're right, you're very hard to. It's very hard for you to show yourself to be wrong, so let them do it. That's odd. It's going to be up to them to show we're wrong. This is a little sleazy, or at least it's a sleight of hand. But the most wondrous thing is, having said all this, he then says, and by the way, let me tell you how to interpret the book of Joshua. Right? Here's how. And it's quite clever, because, you know, he's not half wrong. He says, if you really mean this Ptolemaic business, and you literally command the sun to stand still, it's going to set sooner. Because if the sun stands still, it is not slipping back west to east with its own proper motion. It's fully getting carried by the stellar sphere, and so it sets much sooner. So if Joshua wanted to get the sun to stand still and commanded it to stand still, he blew it. So that's clearly not what he really did. And, you know, all this stuff is... So he had his own way of making the sun hang in the heavens, but it wasn't by asking it to stand still. Although that's what's reported to the rabble, who don't really need to know these mysterious things or difficult things. And he says, I've got a better interpretation, which would be in accord with a literal reading of Scripture, if when Joshua said, sun stand still over Gibeon, if he meant sun stop spinning, then it would have hung still in the heavens. Did you notice that? Why? Because Galileo spins there, the earth spins because the sun spins. So here's a reading. Now, is he just being cute? I mean, what's going on here? Is he just showing them how infinitely more clever he is than they'll ever be? I mean, is that what he's doing? Or does he think there's something to this idea that the sun... I mean, he's quite sure the sun spins because of the way sunspots move, which he's quite sure are on the sun. And he's got pretty good demonstration of that. Now, do you think he believes the earth spins because it's caused to spin by the sun spinning? Well, there's nowhere else he talks about this theory. Everything else, he says, would suggest that he'd find this the most mystical kind of occult powers, and that wouldn't be good science.
There's a passage I pointed out the last time where Castelli, who's in this in-joke with Galileo, says, again, after having made suitable disclaimers, I commence to play the theologian with such assurance and dignity that it would have been good to hear me. So it sounds like they get together and have a good time making fun of these people.
Well, but you see, I mean, what part of what this suggests is that this is still, for me, and I guess for you, you've thought about this a lot less than I have, this is still on the other side of the veil. Because, remember, the letter to Christina is not just something Galileo dashed off one night feeling exuberant. He's written the letter to Castelli. It's been circulating around. It's been raising a lot of stink. And now he's revising it, rewriting it, just for circulation, and there is that stuff at the end of it. Let me interpret the book of Joshua, you turkeys. Here, look, the sun spins, the earth spins. How do you like that? Ha! Right? I mean, it's very hard to know, I think, what he thinks he's doing. But I think the closest I can come to it is he thinks he is so terrific at this stuff that he's really just going to blow these weaker characters away. And people are going to say, right, put him in charge. Put Galileo in charge. He's just dynamite. I mean, I think that's what he imagines. That he's just so good at this stuff. That is, he imagines that he may well be the guy who is going to play an important role in formulating a new policy about science and theology. And that this kind of demonstration, as in the letter to Christina, is going to be understood as reasons why he should be. Look, I'm so... he'd never say it like this. This is too arrogant and transparent, but along the lines of, I'm really so good at these things, I could even make suggestions to the people that do scriptural interpretation. Anyway.
What happens to his supporting family and all the other super supporting? Do they completely sort of drop him at this point?
Or oh, no.
They provide some...
Well, this is an embarrassment.
Yeah, that's what it was.
But most of the embarrassed people are... Oh, well, I don't really know.
The thing is, I know that in that book, the teaching a little boy, that people that live with him have to name.
Well, this is a play by Grant.
Yeah, but isn't that...
It's made up.
Oh, that...
Well, it's not... I mean, it is a play written for particular reasons. Well, it's not entirely made up. No, Galileo continues to have students. What happens after he signs his confession? He's released in the custody of the Archbishop of Siena, one of the Piccolomini family. These are old humanists. And he spends 3 months with the Archbishop in Siena. And it's wonderful. It's like, all right, now that you've signed that, you can... and go to the Caribbean for 3 months. And the Archbishop doesn't lose any face by being the generous host of Galileo, and they're old friends anyway. And he finally gets back to Florence, and he has students. He dictates the discourses on two new sciences to Viviani. And he's also going blind. Not from looking at the sun through a telescope, the way some people think. Because if he did that, he'd have burned a hole right through the back of his head. But just from some kind of thing that happens in old age. So it's not that bad. There are a couple of occasions when he wants to do something and the people monitoring him, the cops, say no. So I mean, it's inconvenient. And he's been humiliated and continues to be humiliated, but there doesn't seem to be any big trouble getting the discourses out to Holland to be published. And when they are published, nobody says, oh, well, now we'd better burn him and it, and so on. So... Well, sure, but you see, I mean, without wishing to apologize for a police state, being on the index isn't such a big deal. Cardinal Bellarmine has 2 books on the index. It's true. I mean, it's almost like having your book banned in Boston or something. It raises interest. Bellarmine has a book on the index because of some... It's a devotional book he wrote, and some little piece of it... I mean, this is automated decision procedure again. You've got some bozo who's done a PhD in administration or something, and here's the rules, right, about things not allowed, and so you examine books, and there's a word that's not allowed, so bang, on the index. Do you see what I mean? I mean, I'm making light of it,
yeah.
But being on the index isn't a terribly big deal. Oh, yeah. No, you have to get them underground somehow. But you can bet the people who want them get them. Although, it's not of much use. I mean, I'm making light of this, but I think it would be true to say that partly as a consequence of the Galileo affair, which everybody knows about throughout Europe, how could they help but, things do go badly. Intellectuals come to realize that that's not the kind of climate in which to do stuff. the church loses a lot of face, and especially outside Italy, and even more especially in those places where, well, it becomes a great, and as you know, because you're a part of it, it becomes a very significant piece of anti-Catholic propaganda. Look what they did to Galileo. You want to know